Okay, so today we're going to talk about Rav Hirsch and Neo-Orthodoxy. I first want to discuss the climate into which Rav Hirsch was born, and then we'll discuss how he reacted to that climate. So until the 18th century, the Jews were viewed with scorn by the outside world. They were viewed as uncultured. They were viewed as archaic, and there was no desire by the outside world, for the most part, to welcome Jews into the world. There was some notion in the 17th century about the useful Jew, meaning the Jew had money. But in terms of a Jew being cultured, the Jews felt the non-Jews were uncultured, and the non-Jews had no desire for the Jews to get involved. And along comes Moses Mendelssohn. He was born in 1729 and he passed away in 1786. He's born in Dessau, which is now known as Germany. He was gifted intellectually. He was very poor. He was physically handicapped. He was a hunchback, because he was a hunchback of Dessau. That he taught himself many languages and philosophy. He wanted to find a way for the Jews to leave the ghetto without assimilating. Many people who are part of the Reform movement trace themselves, they say, we are spiritual descendants of Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn did not want to assimilate, but he did want to leave the ghetto. He integrated himself into non-Jewish society, especially with a man by the name of Ephraim Lessing, a leading German philosopher of the era, and he was also close with the Prussian ruler Frederick Wilhelm. He believed that Judaism should adapt to modernity and that Jews should emerge from the ghetto. He became proof that you don't need to convert to remain with the Jewish identity, at least he himself. He wrote a German translation of the Torah, and it had Hebrew characters. This work was criticized by some rabbis, such as Rabbi Cheskel Landau, the noted Behuda, out of fear that the charm of the German language would lead young Jews to study the translation rather than the Torah itself, and believing that they might be led away from Orthodox Judaism. As we'll see, some of the things that he believed in, I think perhaps many of us believe in, but in his time they were seen by many as very radical. In general, Moses Mendelssohn was perceived by many rabbis to be someone who was personally observant. But they thought that he was the exception, not the rule. That's always the question, right? You know, if you engage in certain behavior, so you yourself, like, you know, we make rules and we have guidelines and recommendations for religious life for the masses, generally speaking. And obviously there are halachos, things you should do and things you shouldn't do. And then there's all this gray area. We say, is this good for the Jews? Is it not good? And certain types of behavior, we could say, you know, for you it's good, but we wouldn't recommend it for the masses. So many rabbis viewed that he was someone that he himself may have been what we would call today a modern Orthodox Jew. He lived a totally secular lifestyle in Berlin, but he never missed a mincha. And the rabbis of his day thought that his approach was too dangerous at that time. According to Daniel Schwartz, in his study of the first modern Jew, he writes that of Mendelssohn's 6 children, 4 converted to Christianity, all following their father's death, and of all of his grandchildren, only 1 went to his grave as a Jew. Additionally, many of his beliefs that he articulated, which in and of themselves may have not crossed the line of being heretical, were extended by some of his followers into becoming heretical beliefs. Let's just read a little bit about what he believed. I have here in the first source. He wrote a lot. This is what he wrote here as Judaism as revealed legislation. So he writes the following. Judaism consists of, or according to the founder's design, was to consist of religious dogmas and propositions of immutable truths of God, of his government providence without which man can neither be enlightened nor happy. So you have certain religious dogmas which are immutable truths. They were not forced in the belief of the people by threats of eternal temporal punishment, but suitably to the nature and evidence of immutable truths, recommended for rational consideration. They needed not be suggested by direct revelation or promulgated by words or writing, which are understood only in this place or that place, at this time, at that time. The Supreme Being revealed them all to all rational beings by events and by ideas, and inscribe them in their soul in a character legible and intelligible at all times and all places. So there's certain rules that, like, if you think about it, these rules make sense. There are certain ways we're supposed to behave that rational people would say this is the correct way to behave. And God sort of created certain scenarios, and he had certain events through which we realize those truths, like maybe what we would call mishpatim. Now, there's certain types of laws that if God would not have told us about it explicitly, if it wasn't revelation, we would still believe. And then he has historical truths, you know, but I'm interested in the third category, which are laws, judgments, commandments, rules of life, which were to be peculiar to that nation, to Jews, and by observing which it was to arrive at national, as well as every single member thereof, at individual happiness. In other words, he says there are certain rules which are intuitive, that we wouldn't need revelation in order to know what to do. And then the third category are revealed laws. The lawgiver was God himself. God not in his revelations creator and preserver of the universe, but God as Lord, protector, and ally of their forefathers, as a liberator, founder, and leader, as a king and ruler of the people. And he gave the laws a sanction, that which nothing could be more solemn. He gave them publicly. This refers to Mamon Har Sinai. So these laws were revealed. They were made known by God by words and in writing. In other words, he believes that there are two aspects of the Torah. You have universal moral laws and are based on reason, and ritual laws which only apply to the Jews. And he writes here, he believes that these laws help us to understand the moral and philosophical ideas of the Torah. Doesn't sound that heretical, right? Sounds normal, right? Reasonable. The challenge is that some of his students said that since the moral ideas of the Torah were meant for all mankind, and since now they live in an era of enlightenment, all mankind was united in the pursuit of good, there is no need for the Jewish people to retain its observance of the Torah's peculiar ritual laws. And they went one step further than him. He said you have to keep the whole Torah, but some of them are, you know, moral laws that for the whole world, universal laws, and then others that are revelation to get to this moral foundation to help us. And so some of his followers said, well, we're already there. We're in the age of the Messiah. We're already there. We have, you know, there's a tremendous amount of optimism in Western Europe at this time, by some, that we're reaching an age, we're all, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder, an age of universalism. So we don't necessarily need all these laws. And again, some also believed, based on the values of secular humanism, so secular humanism, like Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal, he was a humanist, but he was a religious humanist. A secular humanist believes that man decides universal moral ideas. So the Torah is only binding to the extent that we are willing to accept its individual findings. And David Friedlander, who was a student,
they ever applied this reading to the Jews conditions under the Tsarist Russia.
So this is all Western Europe. The Eastern Europe, that's a Haskalah movement. It's not really. They had a totally different way of looking at it. Their reform movement was not that. That was. I think the difference is in Russia, you didn't have that same feeling of like, you know, we're getting out of the ghetto. Like the Russians did not leave them out of the ghetto. So therefore, their movement, their modern movement, took a different shape than the movement in Western Europe.
Well, at that time, the Skull Lude had an event in Eastern Europe in 1800. 1800 really had the depression and
You know, I understand. That's what I'm saying. In other words, in Western Europe, there was this feeling of optimism and openness, of getting out. You didn't have that same hope and optimism in the Eastern Europe, in Eastern Europe. So so David Friedlander, a student of Moses Mendelssohn, said that the Torah is based on the teaching of Moses and not God. Even though Friedlander believed that we should follow the Torah, but once you believe that the Torah is based only on human teachings, again, aka secular humanism, then there is more room to argue for reform of these teachings. In other words, you could say what you want. If this rule seems silly and stupid and doesn't make any sense to me, so you might be right, but if you say God created it, so what can you do? You can be as creative as you want, but it's much harder. Once you take this, again, so Moses Mendelssohn never said this. Moses Mendelssohn said that everything was revealed by God, and then you have these two different aspects, and his students took it one step further. Also, if you believe that we live in an enlightened world of acceptance by non-Jews, as I mentioned, then you take the view that this becomes this era becomes the beginning of a utopian state without the need to return to Yerushalayim. And in 1812, David Friedlander proposed an alteration in the prayer to reflect this belief, where he wrote, "I pray for blessing and prosperity for my compatriots, for myself and my family, not for the return to Jerusalem, not for the restoration of the temple and its sacrifices," and the reform movement, of course, is born. And there are two different types of reforms. I would say there is aesthetic reforms and ideological reforms. The first, there's always a question, do the rabbis begin, or do they come first, or they come second? So here, the rabbis came second. The first reforms were laymen working without rabbinic leadership, and their concern, very simple, membership, you know, shul membership, right? It's always a considerate, right? Right? We got to market, it's a question, how much do you want to reform? This is a question in Orthodox shuls too. How much do we change? We want to attract people, so what do we have to do? So there are a high percentage of German Jews are converting to Christianity because that was their ticket to the outside world. Examples included Heinrich Heine, the German poet. So again, their first goal was Kiruv, in a sense. You may think of reform, Kiruv. But the first goal was actually to keep their membership as Jews, and all these people are converting. So we need to make changes that don't hopefully destroy Judaism, but that keep Jews in Judaism. Just do some initially minor reforms. And the reforms were aimed at updating Judaism in the age of emancipation and Western standards of aesthetics and decorum to make Judaism more attractive. Initial reforms included shortening the davening. Okay. That could be worse things, right? See, if you think about it, davening, right? Davening starts like, you know, with Shmoneh Esrei. And it just keeps on growing over time, growing. And like, no one ever said, okay, if you add something, we're going to take something out. Never did that. So it keeps on growing. And they're like, well, we should cut things down. And also, okay, it's getting a little radical. Just get ready for this. Introducing the sermon in the vernacular. Okay, I know it's a radical thing, okay? I'd have to learn Yiddish now if we would change that. Choral singing with an organ as accompaniment. Now, I just want to say, you know, that's the worst thing in the world, an organ. It's not the worst, I mean, I don't want to say it's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, halakhically, so first of all, if you have non-Jews playing music, just saying, you have Amir Lenachri and for a mitzvah. I mean, what I'm saying is, initially, you can see halakhic arguments by saying it's not necessarily so bad. And even Jews, you know, playing, well, what's going to happen? They're going to fix the musical instrument? Like, you know, I mean, again, I'm not in favor of it. But I'm just saying, in terms of, they weren't like right away, let's go, light fires. Or let's be mechalel isure, let's violate isure d'oraisa. So I think the initial reforms get non-Jews to play music. I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe, I spoke about this once, when the Ramah, the Moshe Ischelis, when he negotiated, there was a story where there was an orphan girl and she was supposed to marry this guy, and the last minute the wedding broke up, or the agreement broke up, and he's negotiating throughout Friday, and Friday night they finally agreed to the terms. He was nervous, he'd wait till Sunday, then the wedding wouldn't take place, and they said, okay, we're gonna marry her right now. And you can't get married on Shabbat, so in Issa Drabon, and he's considered because of Kavod HaBrios, you know, because the wedding would maybe fall apart, so we're going to do it right now. Okay, others post can disagree with him, but that's what he did. And I believe in his tshuva, he does talk about the worst case scenario, you have non-Jews playing music for a tzorach mitzvah. So I'm just saying, again, I don't advocate taking that position, but I'm saying the initial reforms were potentially could be justified, maybe, within halacha. Maybe. Standard, they supplemented some Hebrew prayers with prayer in the vernacular. You know, you have some shuls, right? You know, some shuls, more modern shuls, or shuls, you know, many years ago, I think, you know, you'd have shuls, and some of the people didn't, you know, you had mixed, some were Orthodox, some were not Orthodox, and they'd have some prayers in Hebrew, some prayers in English, and so that was this idea, to make people feel comfortable. The first regular synagogue was established on a reform base. That was established on a reform basis. Was the Hamburg Temple in 1818? It was led by Israel Jacobson, and he did not wish to break with religion. He tried to demonstrate that his innovations were consistent with halacha. However, changes in the liturgy no longer reflect a traditional longing for return to Tzion and a restoration of the Beis HaMikdash and the sacrifices. It was not called a synagogue. It was called a temple. The synagogue stirred these kind of ghetto memories. And when you call something a temple, what are you really saying? We don't need a temple in Jerusalem. Our temple is right here. This idea of a temple. If you look here, this is the constitution of the Hamburg Temple I have here. Since public worship has for some time been neglected by so many, because of the ever-decreasing knowledge of the language in which alone it has until now been conducted, and also because of many other shortcomings which have crept in at the same time, the undersigned, convinced of the necessity to restore public worship to its deserving dignity and importance, have joined together to follow the example of several Israelite congregations, and especially the one in Berlin. They plan to arrange in this city also for themselves, as well as others who think as they do, a dignified and well-ordered ritual according to which the worship service shall be conducted on Sabbath and holy days and on other solemn occasions, and which shall be observed in their own temple, to be erected especially for this purpose. Specifically, there shall be introduced at such services a German sermon and choral singing to the accompaniment of an organ. So this is what's going on now. And so these were the initial reforms starting around 1817, 1818. The next steps of reform were taken by outstanding scholars and rabbis. A reform sitter was written and edited by scholars in 1841. A philosophy of the reform movement developed. You know, you have to develop now a hashkafa now. You know, you have to develop like this. We think certain things, but now we have to articulate what the hashkafa is. There's probably the most famous was someone by the name of Abraham Geiger. He lived from 1810 to 1874. We're going to see. He actually was chavrusas with Rav Shimshon and Paul Hirsch. when they were in university together. But Abraham Geiger was an early Bible critic. He valued a prophetic Judaism with the Jewish mission being to spread rational monotheism and social justice without the archaic rituals that are of no value in the current era. He asserted that biblical Judaism evolved to rabbinic Judaism, which has now evolved to modern Judaism. And there, he said that if you look at the halachos in the Mishnah, the Gemara, it's very different than there was in the Chumash. The Chumash had its own halachos. The rabbinic Judaism had its own halachos, and now we're in a new period. And he says that biblical Judaism evolved to its new era, and with this new era, we have a new set of requirements for the Jew. He also viewed Judaism solely as a religious community. So therefore, he set out to eliminate from Judaism every mark of national uniqueness. So what does that mean if it's not national, it's only religion? What? It's Israel. You know, it's even more than that. It's true, it's not Israel. It's a religion at home. It also means that we wouldn't, yeah, Howie? A religion, and therefore, take it to 2022, we would have no interest in rescuing Jews from Ukraine. I mean, by the way, it doesn't mean we shouldn't rescue non-Jews from Ukraine, but I'm saying the idea that the Jews from Ukraine are our family, and we should rescue, again, I believe we should try to rescue everyone, I'm saying, but obviously you take care of your family more, perhaps, than people who are not part of your family, not to the exclusion, but this idea of the broader Jewish family concerned about, you know, Jews from the broader world, so that's something that the Reform Movement rejected. In the 1840s, the Reform Rabbinical Conferences were held to bring Reform rabbis to clarify and find common ground regarding the philosophical principles of the Reform Movement. There were some rabbis who were more extreme than Geiger. And in the Frankfurt Rabbinical Conference of 1845, radicals sought to limit the use of the Hebrew language to a very small number of crucial prayers. So the conservatives, or more moderate rabbis, walked out of the conference, and the leader of this group, Zacharia Frankel, founded a modern Jewish theological seminary in Breslau, and his movement eventually became ideologically aligned with the conservative movement in the United States. So it goes from traditional Judaism to the Reform movement. Reform goes too far, and so some push back to try to conserve. So what was the Orthodox response to this Reform movement? So even though the initial goals of the Reform movement were to prevent conversion, once the Enlightenment ideals began to spread, prominent Jews vigorously opposed these reforms. And chief among them, probably most famous, who took a more extreme position than Rav Hirsch, was the Chassam Sofer of Moshe Sofer, 1762 to 1839. He was a rabbi, halachic authority. He was a leader of Orthodox Jewry. He was the son-in-law of Rabbi Akiva Eger. He was born in Frankfurt, but he left Frankfurt with his Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler. When Rav Adler was forced to leave because of his opposition to the innovations in the community, and eventually Rav Moshe Sofer becomes the rabbi in Pressburg in 1806. And he founds a yeshiva in Pressburg. It was the largest yeshiva since the Babylonian yeshivos, and he made it the center from which to organize Orthodox Jewry in its struggle against the Reform movement. And this is only happening, based on Howie's question, this is going on in Western Europe. It's not Eastern Europe, it's a totally different animal that we're not speaking about today. What?
Also created the term Orthodox
Judaism. Yeah. Correct. Correct, yes. Orthodox is, originally it was a negative. And, right. So he introduced, Chassam Sofer introduces the famous slogan of the Orthodox, Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. Right? Now it's a play on words, saying that any innovation, even though it may not technically violate halacha, is forbidden simply because it is an innovation. And sometimes, obviously, when we think about those things and we think about certain things that people forbid and being too machmir, and sometimes we may scoff at it. At the same time, just pointing out, again, Moses Mendelssohn, in his time, right, only one grandchild was born, went to the grave being Jewish. So, obviously, that might have been an extreme view, but it may have been very successful, and different religious thinkers take different positions in order to try to deal with this challenge. How much do you accommodate? How much do you take a strong stand in order to, keep people within the fold? He said, I have a quote from here. It's part of a longer response in source 3. This is what he writes in 1819. He says, therefore, you have acted in accordance with the Torah when you declared in your holy synagogue, this is from Chassam Sofer, that it is forbidden to pray from the German prayer books of the Reformers, and that one may pray only in Hebrew according to the versions contained in traditional prayer books. Your prohibition of playing a musical instrument in our holy synagogue, especially on the Holy Sabbath, is also proper. May our hands be strengthened and may God be with you. There is no doubt that all the learned men, the sages of our time, will concur with this prohibition. They agree and I agree in forbidding every soul in Israel to change even one detail of all that is said above. We will thus be saved from all evil and so merit the rebuilding of the temple. And he said, Chassam Sofer said, don't touch the books of Moses Mendelssohn. One should not, as mentioned, you shouldn't pray from Reformed prayer books. And again, this is early on. This is not when the change was so radical. This is like 1819. That's like, you know, a couple years after the first synagogues, the first temples began. He became the leader of the rabbis in Europe who organized themselves between 1817 and 1821 to frustrate the first efforts of the Reform movement in Berlin, Hamburg, and Vienna. And his views on separation from the Reform movement were very strong. Quote, he said, if it were left to me, I would remove Reform completely from the Jewish camp. We should not marry their children, nor should we follow them in any fashion. They are like the Sadducees, the Karaites. We will remain with our tradition and let them leave. The Chassam Sofer, and again, you think it's harsh, but he was dealing with a movement that was sweeping the nation. Yeah.
Yeah, so, but there's a real life context going on.
Right.
What's this movement saying? What are they recommending about integration with the modern world?
The Reform movement?
Not the Reform movement.
No,
the Orthodox movement.
So again, so Chassam Sofer is like whatever they want, like don't get involved. He said we don't need this.
I'm talking in general.
You had some. I don't think that they were. I think that there are many Jews who are converting. You had very high conversion rates. You had many Jews. Many Jews felt because.
Professional
integration. Okay, so if you convert, there are like these crazy statistics. I don't have it on me, but there are like very, very high, alarming rates of conversion as a ticket to the outside world. We're not talking about Eastern Europe where they're living in the shtetl. In Western Europe, so then if you want to move up economically, you got to convert. So they felt, man, you don't have to convert the Reform movement. So then you don't have to convert. Then you can you could still if you act more cultured, then they're going to accept you. But a high percentage of Jews, like really high, staggering percentage of Jews, are converting. And they're just the main fight by the Chassam Sofer and his group is like, you know, you just got to stay away. They're going to lead you to complete disaster. It is what it is. Some people, you know, wealthy bankers did well, but it was harder. It was harder to integrate. There's no question it was hard to integrate. You had to convert as a ticket to entrance. And so this, maybe the Reform movement may have saved for one generation some people from converting. But I'm just saying, even without Reform, you know, very high percentage of Western Europe converting to Christianity. Not because they believe, because this is their ticket into society. So this was the climate in which Rav Hirsch finds himself. So let's just talk a bit about an early biographical sketch of Rav Hirsch and how he dealt with this movement. Rav Hirsch is born, Shimshon Ephal Hirsch is born on June 20th, 1808. In Hamburg. He's the first child of Raphael and Gela Hirsch. His parents named him Shimshon or Samson. He used his father's name, Shamshon Raphael. Raphael was his father's name. So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, that apparently was the custom. He had a close relationship with his parents and his grandfather, Mendel Frankfurter, a great Talmudic scholar. He was the Rosh Beis Din of Altona, had a profound influence on his grandson. There were other rabbis German rabbis who had a major influence on Rav Hirsch, Rav Yitzchak, Chacham Yitzchak Barnes, the rabbi of Hamburg, Rav Yaakov Etlinger, the Binyan Letzion. He was the head of the yeshiva in Mannheim where Rav Hirsch attended. They had tremendous influence on Rav Hirsch. And there was a new legal requirement for rabbis in Germany. So that they had to have secular education. So Rav Etlinger advised Rav Hirsch to study at a university. So Rav Hirsch studied at the University of Bonn, and he befriended the slightly younger Abraham Geiger, as I mentioned. And they were Gemara Chavrusas. But Rav Hirsch left 1 year before earning a degree. Rav Hirsch's father was a merchant. He wanted his son to go into business, but Rav Hirsch decides to become Rav Hirsch. He decides to become a rabbi. And the religious controversies in his native town in Hamburg had a primary influence in shaping his career. Remember, the first temple was in Hamburg in 1818. So like this is going on when he's like 10 years old. The Hamburg rabbinate, as well as some of the leading rabbinic personalities, issued a prohibition against praying in the temple or using its prayer book. And his home was often the venue of like meetings and strategy sessions called to combat the threat posed to Torah Judaism by this new temple. And young Samson was deeply affected by the gatherings in his parents' home. In his later years, recalled that it was this struggle which gave him the first impetus to pursue his calling in life. So what was his rabbinate like? So first, he was the rabbi of Oldenburg from 1830 to 1841. So that's when he started, when he was 22. He was the rabbi in Emden from 1841 to 1847. He was like the district rabbi of Moravia from 1847 to 1851. Before, he is most famously known, he accepted the call of a tiny religious association in Frankfurt called the, I can't even pronounce this well, Israelitische Religiongesellschaft. I'm probably not pronouncing it well. But it's in Frankfurt. That's where he became known as the rabbi in Frankfurt from 1851 until 1888. He is the rabbi in Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, he builds institutions, both educational and congregational, which help stem the tide of the Reform movement. He believed in the philosophy of Torah im Derech Eretz, that an ideal Jew was an enlightened Jew. So we're not afraid of the outside world, that you're an enlightened Jew who observed mitzvos, and he created a community of frum balabatim. He didn't create a community of gedolei Yisrael. He created a community of frum balabatim. And it could be the failure of Moses Mendelssohn was he had a nice ideology. But maybe in order to support an ideology, you can't just have an ideology. You have to have a communal structure. And that's what Rav Hirsch built. His schools included secular studies such as German, math, and natural sciences. And he rejected the notion that combination of traditional Judaism and secular education was impossible. Let's see one of his quotes. I just picked some of his quotes here. This is from collected writings. It's source 4. He says the following: "It would be most perverse and criminal of us to seek to instill in our children a contempt based on the ignorance and untruth for everything that is not specifically Jewish, for all other human arts and sciences, in the belief that by inculcating our children with such a negative attitude, we could safeguard them from contacts with the scholarly and scientific endeavors of the rest of mankind. You will then see that your simple-minded calculations were just as criminal as they were perverse." It's like, number one, you're wrong, and it's not going to work to shelter your children from other secular studies. Criminal because they are enlisted the help of untruth, supposed in order to protect the truth. And because you have thus departed from the path upon which your own sages have preceded you and beckon you to follow them. In other words, he's saying that Chazal say, you should believe in the wisdom of the world, of even non-Jews. And it's perverse because by so doing, you have achieved precisely the opposite of what you wanted to accomplish. Your child will consequently begin to doubt all of Judaism, which can exist only in the night and darkness of ignorance, and which must close its eyes and the minds of its adherents to the light of all knowledge if it is not to perish. He's saying like, you need broad education in order to fully appreciate, even your Judaism will suffer if you just say this is all treif. And we see in today's world, some people, it works for some and it doesn't work for others. So he felt strongly about that. He added a choir under the direction of a professional musical conductor, and he supported the participation of congregational singing, and he preached twice a month in German. However, the prayers remained only in Hebrew. So he does some reforms, but he's not going to change the davening. He wore a clerical robe in Shul. I think they do that still in Jewish Center, right? Still do that. Okay. Yeah. Probably wear a t-shirt and shorts underneath, right? Okay. Yeah, they're the robes. So in contrast to Mendelssohn, whose descendants, see, this is always a test. My general philosophy is like, you know, if someone has a great idea for doing certain things about, you know, Judaism should do this, and Judaism should do that, and we should do this, we should do that. So for me, they might be good in theory. I'd be nervous to be the guinea pig. I want to see, like, what's the result, right? In other words, Mendelssohn's Hashkafa, like, almost all of his kids, grandkids, they convert. So in a world where, according to some studies, two-thirds of Jews in Western Europe convert to Christianity around this time. All 10 of Rav Hirsch's children live to be adults, which is amazing in and of itself, from a medical standpoint, and remain faithful to Judaism. Okay? Now, Rav Hirsch's writings. So Rav Hirsch's first work is called The 19 Letters. This is published in 1836, and it's a refutation of... So how old is he? He's like 28. Right, so this is a refutation of reform ideas and his view of orthodoxy. So what are the 19 letters? It's a letter to a fictional Uziel as to why he should keep Judaism. The first letter is the question, and the next 18 letters is the response. He was actually friendly with Abraham Geiger until Geiger published a critique of his work here. Now, this work was the beginning of his active struggle against the reformers. If you look here in, this is an example in letter 17, this is source 5. He says, "Certainly, dear Benjamin, we are far from being what we should be, and if you compare the life ideal which the Torah desires us to realize, even according to the scanty outlines which I have drawn for you in these letters, with our actual life as individuals and as a community, you will at once discern how numerous are the steps which we must still make, and how great the distance yet to be climbed before we can reach the glorious summit of our aspiration and our hope." As we're far from our ideal now. "Therefore, may our motto be reform. Let us strive with all our power, with all the good and noble qualities of our character, to reach the height of ideal perfection, reform." So first it's like, yeah, I believe in reform. "Its only object, however, must be the fulfillment of Judaism by Jews in our time. Fulfillment of the eternal idea in harmony with the conditions of the time." In other words, we reform ourselves by observing Judaism. "Education, progress to the Torah height. Not, however, lowering the Torah to the level of the age, cutting down the towering summit to the sunken grade of our life. We Jews need to be reformed through Judaism, newly comprehended by the Spirit and fulfilled with the utmost energy. But merely, need to be reformed, but merely seek greater ease and comfort in life through the destruction of the eternal code set up for all ages by the God of eternity is not, we need to be reformed through Judaism, but merely to seek greater ease and comfort in life through the destruction of the eternal code set up for all ages by the God of eternity is not and never can be reformed." I'm into reform. I'm into we need to change ourselves. But to just make life easier, like what some Jews have proposed, that's not reform for the benefit of Judaism. "Judaism seeks to lift us up to its height. How dare we attempt to drag it down to our level?" So again, he writes that Jews and not Judaism is in need of reform. We are in need of elevation. Jews need to rise to the eternal ideals of Judaism and not bring it down to adjust to the requirements of contemporaries who desired merely a more comfortable life. This work was actually more positive in nature. But after he was rebuffed by the reformers, like at that time he thinks he can, you know, bring some in and try to make some shalom, but he becomes more oppositional and he in his language. And he gradually emerges as Orthodoxy's most uncompromising and militant defender. He also writes Chorev, which was published in 1838, which sets forth the philosophy of the mitzvos. In it, he goes to the mitzvos and why we should observe them. And other major works included a commentary on the Siddur, Pirkei Avos and Tehillim, and of course his commentary on the Torah. And what's remarkable is, right, he writes this about 200 years ago, and you're still, his messages are so contemporary, even today in 2022. Like a lot of stuff that people quote, very contemporary to what's going on in society today. You look back to Rav Hirsch, he writes about it 200 years ago in such an articulate way. You know, sometimes we think that, you know, when we think about what's a modern Orthodox thinker? So we think about those people who are open to outside culture, who are Zionistic, and who are open to working with the broader community. Right? That's a fair definition very often of a modern Orthodox thinker. Right? Even though Rav Hirsch was open to outside culture, he believed that his Orthodox community should separate from the Jewish community made up of Reform congregations. This is, he called this Ostrit, meaning secession, meaning establishing an independent organization. In other words, don't join the New York Board of Rabbis. He was not into that. Now, Rav Hirsch only advocated secession in Frankfurt and not in prior communities where he was the rabbi, because in Frankfurt, the Reform movement gained influence over the Jewish community. So when the Prussian government in 1875 passed a law that enabled multiple Jewish communities to form independent communities, Rav Hirsch wrote that the Orthodox community must secede. Now, other German rabbis disagree with him. Rav Seligman Bar Bamberger of Würzburg disagreed. And the truth is, most members of the Orthodox Jewish community did not leave the Jewish community as a whole. Rav Hirsch believed that the community exists for the sake of Torah. So a community that does not act according to the Torah forfeits its right to exist, and you may not belong to that Jewish community. In fact, Rav Hirsch wrote that associating with the Reform congregations is tantamount to endorsing heresy. So again, on some issues that we look at Rav Hirsch, very modern, but on other issues that we might consider nowadays is a position of a modern Orthodox rabbinic leader, in this respect, he did not represent those thinkings. And in fact, also another issue about Zionism. So what was Rav Hirsch's attitude towards Zionism? And again, even though he was a modern thinker, he was not inclined to the Zionist movement that began to emerge towards the end of his life. And again, it's not to say that if he was alive today, he would think differently. But when he lived, he was not inclined towards the Zionist movement. When Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who was one of the earlier rabbinic Zionist leaders of the 19th century, tried to resettle Eretz Yisrael within the framework of the Zionist movement, the Chovei Tzion, Rav Hirsch refused to cooperate. If you look here in the last source I have, is source 6, he writes the following. He says, "Land and soil were never Israel's bond of union, but only the common task of the Torah. Therefore, it still forms a united body, though separated from a national soil. Nor does this unity lose its reality, though Israel accept everywhere the citizenship of the nations amongst which it is dispersed. The coherence of sympathy, this spiritual union, which may be designated by the Hebrew terms Am and Goy, but not by nation, unless we are able to separate from the term the concept of common territory and political power, is the only communal band we possess or ever expect to possess until the great day shall arrive when God shall see fit in his inscrutable wisdom to unite again his scattered servants in one land, and the Torah shall be the guiding principles of his state, an example of the meaning of divine revelation, the mission of humanity." In other words, wait for a God to bring the people back to Eretz Yisrael. But right now, you know what makes it the community? Torah. "For this future, which is promised us in the glorious predictions of the inspired prophets whom God raised up for our ancestors, we hope and we pray." We daven for kibbutz galuyos. We daven for return back to Eretz Yisrael. But actively to accelerate its coming where sin and is prohibited to us, while the entire purpose of the Messianic age is that we may, in prosperity, exhibit to mankind a better example of Israel than did our ancestors the first time, while hand in hand with us, the entire race will be joining universal brotherhood through the recognition of God, the All One. So you see, but it makes sense why Rav Hirsch would say this. Because Rav Hirsch also sees an enlightened, you know, universalistic, he has that enlightened universalistic approach, Torah in Derech Eretz, we should embrace the outside culture, but again, through the prism of Torah, you know, together with Torah. And he's also thinking, you know, we are living in this enlightened world. We cannot at all eliminate the Torah. The Torah is our set of values. But he's saying, this is, you know, this notion of us being an Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations. What can be a better way to be an Or LaGoyim, to live amongst the non-Jews, be viewed as people who are ethical and honest, at the same time, God-fearing. I mean, that, and then when God, we daven for returning to Eretz Yisrael, when Hashem decides, He'll decide. So, what's interesting, again, is that, again, he writes, he asserted in some of his works, and you think this is like a Satmar position, he asserted that Zionist activity is a violation of the three oaths of Maseches Ksuvos. That's what the Satmar community says. That, and they, these oaths remain in effect, I'll explain what they are, as long as the nation of the world oppose such settlement. Now again, you can argue that after again the San Remo conference, or after the UN partition plan, so then the nations allowed us. But I'm saying this position, the three oaths, to like a Hirsch, he's a modern thinker. But again, it depends on the particular issue. And the fact that he was not progressive in this regard, again, he's living in Western Europe when there's a lot of hope for universal. He's not living in Russia where you're living under the czars and you think life is miserable. I'm just saying, like, he's living in a world where he's saying maybe the goal is going to be we are going to observe our Torah together with being good citizens, and we're going to, you know, be a light unto the nations. When God has seen that we've done our part, He's going to bring us to Eretz Yisrael. Again, what would He say nowadays? What would we say? It's not to say nowadays He would say the same thing, but that was His approach at that time.
Right.
Yeah.
Mixed in the land.
I hear. But the issue that I have, I mean, is that like a subconscious thought? Maybe. No, what I'm saying is, like, he writes about it in many different places, that it's like, you could say that, like, I hear the argument, but like, he writes this as a philosophy in many different works. And to say the Gimel Shavuot, like, you could say that, I just don't know. But I'm saying, like, he writes it as his philosophy. What? I'm sorry, I apologize. So the Gimel Shavuos, I apologize. So the truth is, the Gimel Shavuos, two of them are on us, and one of them is on the non-Jews. So one of them is that we're not going to build a wall, right? We're not going to rebel against the nations, and we're not going to build a wall around, you know, our cities in Eretz Yisrael. It means we're not going to forcibly try to build Eretz Yisrael against the will of the non-Jews. And the third is that the non-Jews will not try to enslave us, make our lives too miserable. So, for example,
miserable?
Too miserable. No. So, for example, this in Gemara Ksuvot. It's based on a pasuk in Gemara Ksuvot. It's based on a pasuk in Shir Shirim that says that I think it's im toru es hava achitechbatz. If you reawaken my love until Hashem desires. Now, so that's a question. How do you respond to that? So, when we respond to that, is again that the nations agreed to it by the UN resolution, the San Remo conference. Another way is to say that these conditions were dependent on each other, that we won't try to start our own land, and if they don't enslave us too much, certainly after the Holocaust, we make the argument that they have done it too much. So these are debates in terms of that. He also wrote, Rav Hirsch also wrote, that, quote, in my lowly opinion, there will not emerge from this any benefit, referring to Zionism, any benefit for Torah and Jewish tradition, and it is not fitting for God fearing people to associate with the Alliance Israelite Universal, whose leaders lack all commitment to Torah and to God's covenant. So another issue, just one second, another issue is that he's also against cooperating with the non-Orthodox. So that's, I think, another issue as well that's consistent with his austere position, where, again, he believes in living an ideal and enlightened life with, you know, seeing the Torah alongside with secular values, but he's not going to work together with these non-Orthodox organizations. So that probably also influences his decision on the early Zionist movement. Yeah, Howie, you had a question?
It seems like self-fulfillment. He said that Israel was founded as a non-state, but the religious refused to cooperate in the founding of the state.
Right.
Like, Rishon LeZion was the first settlement founded.
Right.
But the problem was,
Right. Rav Aaron Salvation makes your point, and he says that, you know, some say that the Rav Aaron Salvation makes the point. I think your point is he makes the point that he says that, you know, the Navi, you know, can you have redemption? Can you have the final redemption without, you know, without tshuva? So he brings proofs, and that's not necessarily the case. But he said more than that. He said, like, had, you know, he's saying you shouldn't have, had, imagine had there been a mass of from Jews coming to Israel and the founding state, we'd be in such much better state religiously, because we didn't, the religious didn't embrace it, so now we're paying the price. So, yeah. So what's Rav Hirsch's legacy? So Rav Hirsch's legacy is neo-Orthodoxy or new Orthodoxy. Orthodox literally means one doctrine, and it was originally viewed as an insult. Neo-Orthodoxy is related probably to modern Orthodoxy, a successfully westernized Orthodox Jew. Rav Hirsch's legacy, as I mentioned, is from Balabatim, where Judaism is relevant in the modern world. But it's also separation from the broader Jewish community when necessary. And as I mentioned, he produced from Balabatim Benat Talmidei Chachamim. As I said, they've seen Rav Hirsch and Rav Soloveitchik.
Who was the next generation?
No, so they had, but it wasn't like his institution. It's like, it's like, take YU for example. So they believe in this idea of Torah Mada, secular studies as well. And they produce, like in the yeshivos, they produce a lot of Talmidei Chacham. There's a lot of serious learning. It's not the same. They didn't have the same serious learning going on in Rav Hirsch's institutions, in his communal structure, as you had in some of the Eastern European yeshivas. They had, coming from the Hildesheimer Seminary, they had some, but it wasn't the same caliber. No, so you had individuals. Some of them, by the way, one of the more famous, the last head of the Hildesheimer, the Berlin Seminary, Rabbinic Seminary before World War II, was the Sridi Eish, Michiel Yaakov Weinberg. So he was someone, for example, who learned in Slobodka, the yeshivas in Eastern Europe, and then he got a position. You know, it's like here, you have yeshivish rabbis, they teach in the monorthodox schools, right? until the monorthodox schools produce enough rabbeim to be able to, you know, have monorthodox rabbeim teach. That's the same issue. So as I mentioned, like Rav Israel Hildesheimer built a rabbinic seminary based on Rav Hirsch's ideology. Now, many East European Torah leaders opposed this ideology. So I'll just give an example. In the 1920s, 1930s, I believe, the Sridi Eish, Michiel Yaakov Weinberg, wanted to move the Berlin Seminary, Rabbinical Seminary, from Berlin to Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, and Michiel Yaakov Weinberg was close to Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, and Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski blocked the move. He was like the Gadol Hador, as he and many believed that Rav Hirsch's views were based on what he called Hora'a Sha'a, and only for German Jews to stop assimilation. It's not the ideal. In other words, He could have his yeshiva in Berlin, but don't move it to Israel, okay? We'll have our own hashkafas in Israel. Ultimately, I think, Rav Hirsch demonstrated that it is possible to live in the modern world as a from Jew as long as you are prepared, as long as you have prepared yourself to separate from some parts of the Jewish community when necessary. And many, many of his ideas and values and thoughts about Judaism in the modern era are so still relevant for our community in 2022.